This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Today on the Breakfast Grill, I am talking to Dr. Malcolm Davis, the senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute out of Canberra, Australia. And of course, Dr. Davis, thank you for talking to us. Malcolm, we've spoken on ANKL before. As a war analyst, you were focused on the Chinese military modernization of that force, air and space power. And of course, you look at very closely Australian defense policy, naturally. Let's begin with a lull in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, triggered by peace talks where the Ukraine might opt for neutrality, similar to what you see in Australia. Austria, Sweden, Finland as well. Now, two questions to start. Can the Ukraine really do this given its proximity to what is clearly a warmongering Russia? I think secondly as well, will Russia really stop now given NATO's eastwards incursion since transgressing the Minsk agreements in 1997?
Look, I think they're both great questions. And I think from Ukraine's perspective, they have to be sceptical that the Russians are genuine about any peace talks. Certainly, if you look at Putin's statements, there was one that came out today. He hardly seems in the frame of mind to sit down and actually talk peace. Secondly, you know, Ukraine has been burned once before with the 1994 Budapest memorandum, where supposedly they gave up their nuclear forces in return for peace guarantees and security guarantees. And here we are now in 2022 with Russian forces invading the country. So I think that any settlement is going to be fraught with peril. It's going to be difficult to achieve. You know, there's discussion about neutrality, but how do you achieve neutrality when that state is directly threatened by a power like Russia? You know, we talk about Austria and Switzerland as neutral states. Well, fine. They're not directly threatened by a neighbour with thousands of nuclear weapons. So I think it's going to be much more difficult for a country like Ukraine to remain neutral. And already, you know, Western states are saying, well, look, we need to provide security guarantees to Ukraine in any peace accord. So that's going to be a challenge. How do you match security guarantees with a supposed neutral state? And the final aspect of this discussion about peace settlements is that the Russians are still claiming Donetsk and Luhansk in the Donbass, as well as Crimea, as theirs. And I really don't see Ukraine being prepared to give up significant portions of its territory to Russia. They might be prepared to bargain on the language about membership of NATO, but I think giving up territory in return for stopping Russian aggression may be going too far.
Yeah, Malcolm, do you think, I mean, it's a response to the second part of the question, do you think that Putin stops with the Ukraine, assuming a re-escalation occurs, which, as you say, it might occur, but do you think Putin stops in the Ukraine, or does he go further westwards?
Well, that's the thing. Any peace settlement now essentially would have to reward Putin for the aggression that he's undertaken in order to get a peace settlement. He's got to get something out of it. And so that would embolden him down the track to either do one of two things, either relaunch the war against Ukraine and go deeper and take more of Ukraine and threaten Kyiv and threaten the Zelensky government, or launch a war somewhere else in Central Europe. Because after all, before the war even began, when Russia was laying down its demands, one of its key demands was for NATO to withdraw to 1997 borders and to give Russia a sphere of influence over Central Europe. That includes the Baltic states, it includes Poland, it includes Hungary, it includes Romania, and so forth. So I don't really see that a peace settlement now does anything to solve the long-term Russian challenge that NATO would face. And if anything, I think it would bake in or strengthen the need for NATO to dramatically boost its defensive capabilities along its eastern frontier to prevent a further Russian aggression. So irrespective of how this ends, we are going to be in for a long period of tension with the Russians.
The sense I'm getting from you is that this current detente is only temporary and it's going to re-escalate sometime soon. That goes as far as including Zelensky's plea to the US Congress, I think a couple nights ago, that you know, it wanted the US to declare the Ukraine a no-fly zone. Well, that also means that NATO and the US have got to defend that no-fly zone, which necessitates an escalation in the conflict. How long does that no-fly... What do you think Biden does? Does he give in to the demands of the electorate and go for the no-fly zone declaration, or do you think he doesn't escalate it and wait for Putin to show his hand?
Yeah, well, firstly, let me say there's no detente. The Russians are still bombing civilian cities. They hit a building full of children this morning, and I don't know how many it did. So I would challenge the notion that there's a detente. In terms of, secondly, the no-fly zone, Zelensky is being very forceful in pushing that forward. But if we do it, we have to go in with our eyes open and recognize the risks. If we're going to bring in a no-fly zone, then we have to enforce it against Russian violations. And that means we have to shoot down Russian aircraft, and they will try to shoot down our aircraft. And so the challenge then becomes, once both sides have maybe taken losses, the challenge then is, how do you manage the escalation dynamics going from the no-fly zone all the way up to a broader war between NATO and Russia, leading to crossing the nuclear threshold and using nuclear weapons? And that's the reason why the West is really reticent to do it, because they can see that, you know, there's no way you can just put in a no-fly zone and no one will challenge it. This is not Iraq, it's not Serbia, this is Russia. And they will challenge it, and we have to shoot down their aircraft. So we know what follows then.
Yeah, so does Biden show his hand first, or does Putin show his hands? What's your sense?
Look, I think it's more likely that Putin will go first, probably with an escalation to use of chemical weapons in essentially a false flag operation essentially break the defense of Ukrainian forces around Kyiv and around other Russian cities.
So you're saying that Putin wants the war to escalate?
Yes,
that's your sense.
Exactly. It's very clear that he's determined to go all the way. He seeks to control and capture most of Ukraine. Whether he seeks to go to the far west, I think, is open to debate. But certainly, he wants to capture Kyiv. He wants to capture all of the south, including Odessa, and obviously the east, including Kharkiv. Look, I think that he will escalate rather than de-escalate. He won't necessarily seek peace. Or if he does seek peace, and we're back to our original point, it'll be a false peace before building up to a second war down the track. So I do think we are in a really dangerous period here where we're likely to see Russian use of chemical weapons on the battlefield. How NATO then responds to that development is the key question. Is that a game changer? Is that a trigger then for a NATO no-fly zone? Once that no-fly zone goes in, then we pretty much are guaranteed to see escalation going up from there, potentially including use of nuclear weapons. Possibility is that Russia does what's known as escalate to de-escalate, whereby they use a small tactical nuclear weapon as a demonstration effect to NATO to back off and to force the Ukrainians to surrender. So this has been talked about for many years as Russian nuclear doctrine. They detonate a small tactical nuke and say, look, we're prepared to go further, are you? And the uncertainty in the West would the Biden administration then risk nuclear war at that point?
Right. It's very distressing, Malcolm. Let's talk about China for the time being, because at the same time that Zelensky was addressing the US Congress in the middle of this week, China's ambassador to the US, Qin Kang, wrote in a Washington Post op-ed that a few things, but namely, firstly, that China had no prior knowledge of Russia's military action, which is contrary to what people reckon, that any conflict between the Russians and the Ukrainians does no good for China, especially from an energy supply perspective. That seems to hold water. And had China known about the imminent crisis, it would have tried its best to prevent it. So those 3 points, what do you think of those comments?
Look, I don't believe the Chinese had no prior knowledge of this. Putin and Xi Jinping sat down in March before the Winter Olympics to sign an agreement of unlimited cooperation between Russia and China. It would have been highly likely that Putin would have discussed this with Xi, and if he hadn't, it would have been highly likely that the Chinese intelligence community would have known about Russia's plans to invade Ukraine, because all of the forces were being pushed together up against the Ukrainian border in the months leading up to that. So, you know, it's not credible for the Chinese to claim that they didn't know about this prior to the invasion being launched. Secondly, I suspect that they would not have intervened to try and prevent the war, because it's actually in China's interest for the US and its allies to be bogged down in a major security crisis in Europe, because it makes them less able to then pivot to build up capability in the Indo-Pacific to respond to China. So China is effectively exploiting this war in Europe to essentially focus US attention away from the Indo-Pacific, whilst they have their own agenda and ambitions here in the Indo-Pacific, including obviously Taiwan. I mean, yes, there's economic, significant economic problems for China coming out of this war in terms of potential impact on international trade. But I think that in the longer term strategic agenda that the Chinese have, it actually makes sense for the Chinese to give some sort of support, political, obviously they're doing that. Economic, maybe they're going to do that. Military, potentially, some sort of support to Russia to keep Putin in power, to prevent him from losing the war and being removed from office, because Putin and Xi are very close. And I don't see the Chinese essentially pulling the rug out from under him.
We're talking this morning to Dr. Malcolm Davis, the senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He's a war analyst and, of course, is looking very closely at the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And, of course, we're going to come back after this, Malcolm, and talk about China and its statements, what appears to be quite confusing statements on Taiwan. After this, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
We are talking this morning to Dr. Malcolm Davis, a senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. The second part of Chin Kang's op-ed in the Washington Post last night, Malcolm, or 2 nights ago rather, was that he said that rumours linking Taiwan and Ukraine to play up the risk of a conflict in the Taiwan Strait are a mistake. And that because while Ukraine is a sovereign state, Taiwan is an inseparable part of China's territory. So those two statements, very profound and very meaningful in terms of where China sits. What do you think about these two statements?
Well, look, I think there was obviously concern that, you know, as Russia was going into Ukraine, China would seek to exploit that and exploit the fact that the US attention was focused on Europe to make moves against Taiwan. I don't think that was ever very likely, because the Chinese People's Liberation Army are still undergoing a process of modernization to develop key capabilities necessary for them to essentially invade and annex Taiwan. You know, it's a significant operation in terms of a cross-straits invasion, which are going up against a significant opponent. If anything, the Chinese are watching what the Russians are doing in Ukraine and seeing how badly the Russian military is getting mauled by a smaller force. And they would be factoring that into their thinking in terms of a future cross-straits invasion. So I was never convinced by the arguments going around that as Russia was going to go into Ukraine, China would go into Taiwan. Having said that, I do think that, as we were discussing before, it makes sense for the Chinese if the Americans are kind of bogged down in Europe dealing with Russia. Secondly, the Chinese are watching what is happening in terms of the Ukraine-Russia crisis and learning a lot of lessons from that, both in terms of what to do and what not to do. And I think one of the key lessons is that they have to have their logistics support fully on board rather than going in guns blazing without even thinking about logistics, which is what the Russians have done in Ukraine. Thirdly, I would argue that the Chinese would be looking at how Putin has used nuclear threats at the beginning of this crisis to effectively checkmate and deter Western intervention. And they'll be thinking, well, maybe China's declaratory policy of no first use on nuclear weapons is the wrong thing to do. Maybe nuclear weapons are useful in terms of deterring military intervention at the tactical and the operational level. So it could be that when the Chinese do invade Taiwan, they might use the same tactic as Putin has done in regards to nuclear threats. They might make implicit nuclear threats and rattle nuclear sabers. Obviously, you know, you could argue that from the Chinese perspective, they see Taiwan as part of their country.
Well, they've said as much. They've said that reunification is necessary. And, you know, he's obviously told the US that they should retain all options to curb, in partnership with China, to curb Taiwan independence. Now, the thing is, Xi Jinping goes in for re-election for an unprecedented third time, right? And there seem to be no obstacles to his re-election in the top echelon of Chinese government. He's also, quite interestingly, worked with his government to remove, you know, what's appeared to be in the past curbs, obstacles to Chinese capital markets. And of course, last night we saw the Hang Seng and the Chinese tech stocks go berserk. Now, how do we read those few dot plots in terms of, you know, China's next move, assuming Xi Jinping gets re-elected? Does the Chinese capital markets help to fund whatever plans Xi Jinping might have down the line, military or non-military? And of course, I think most importantly, what do we do in ASEAN? How do we position ourselves?
First point is that I would make is that we need to watch what China is going to do in terms of assisting Russia. If China does assist Russia by providing economic lifelines that allow it to avoid the worst of the sanctions, and secondly, by providing actual military support in a material sense, then you will see the US and the Western community heavily sanction China. So then China's economy could start to suffer. And that could affect Xi's calculus in terms of how far it goes to support Russia. Secondly, it would obviously start to impact on Chinese economic growth, which will then have a knock-on effect on Chinese defense spending. But I do think that from Xi's perspective, invading and annexing Taiwan, and remember, the Taiwanese don't see themselves as part of China. They see themselves as Taiwanese, and most Taiwanese do not want unification with China on China's terms. Okay, they want the status quo. But from Xi's perspective, taking back Taiwan is vital for his grip on power. So I don't see, however this crisis in Ukraine turns out, short of full-on nuclear war, I don't see that changing Xi's calculus or decision-making regarding Taiwan in the next few years. The way I see the PLA modernization process occurring and Xi's decision-making going, I would argue that the next steps for China in regards to Taiwan is a gray zone coercive campaign to try and convince Taiwan to accept the 1992 consensus and unification on China's terms. I think that will fail because the Taiwanese people have seen what's happening in Hong Kong and Xinjiang and they don't want a bar of it. And so therefore, Xi will be forced to think about the use of force probably around the middle of this decade, which is when the PLA will be ready. And by then, the Chinese will have incorporated all the lessons from Russia's experience in Ukraine, so they'll be better prepared.
We are talking this morning to Dr. Malcolm Davis, the senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. We're, of course, discussing the Russia-Ukraine conflict and China's involvement in it potentially. Now, how does the US behave? How does it choose between the European region, well, Europe and Asia-Pacific? That's what we're talking about here, in essence, Malcolm.
Yeah, and the US is in a difficult spot. Because on the one hand, China is the major pacing threat. It's the long-term strategic threat to the US. And the US simply can't ignore it. They have to position forces in both location and number to be able to deter and counterbalance China. And they have to be able to work with key Indo-Pacific allies such as Japan, Australia, South Korea, and the ASEAN states to counterbalance China. But on the other hand, they can't turn their backs on Europe and NATO right at the point when NATO is much more directly threatened by an aggressive Russia. So somehow the US has to do both, which will require future administrations to dramatically boost defense spending and increase the pace of defense modernization. And secondly, it will require the current and future US administration to count and rely more on key allies to burden share to a much greater degree in the region.
Yeah, and of course, I've been reading your articles in the past few months, and one of the things that you talked about was something very relevant to Malaysia, which is that the South China Sea could be a key locus, location for any brewing Asia-Pacific conflict. How do countries like Malaysia, 10 or 12 ASEAN countries, how do we position ourselves where we have no real political alignment other than doing business with both the superpowers?
Well, ironically, what you're talking about is where Australia was a few years back, where we tried to sort of balance on the precipice between, on the one hand, our strategic alliance with the United States versus our trading relationship with China on the other. And in the end, we found it impossible to keep that balance point because China became extremely coercive against Australia, particularly after about 2015 onwards. So we've, you know, essentially made our strategic choice, and we are now aligning firmly with the United States as the most important relationship. I think in terms of ASEAN, they are going to have to eventually make the same choice. They can't continue to maintain this non-aligned position for too much longer, because this strategic competition between the US and China is intensifying, it's coming, and the crisis over Taiwan is on the horizon. And so the ASEAN states are going to have to shift from a non-aligned posture to an aligned posture. And from Canberra's perspective, the key question is, which way do they shift? Do they align with the US and strengthen multilateralism and a free and open Indo-Pacific? Or do they align with China and essentially strengthen China's hand in building a Chinese-led security order in the region?
Okay, so I'm sure that you've been looking at this very closely, both from a current perspective and from a historical perspective as well, Malcolm. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes left. What do your crystal balls tell you? How does it all end?
The best case scenario in Russia-Ukraine is that Putin is removed from power, everything de-escalates, and hopefully we have a more approachable regime in Moscow that we can maybe do business with and come to some sort of peaceful result there. Worst case scenario in Europe is a wider NATO-Russia war, including potentially the risk of use of nuclear weapons. In terms of Indo-Pacific region, I think that you'll see China watching, learning, preparing for when they do use military force to take Taiwan around about the middle of this decade. And then the region has to choose how it's going to respond, because the arguments that somehow Taiwan is part of China simply don't wash. They are, from the Taiwanese perspective, they are a democratic state of 28 million people, that if they are lost to China, then the whole region in the Indo-Pacific is at risk, in the same way that if Ukraine is lost to Russia, then the whole region in Europe is at risk.
All right, Malcolm, thank you so much for your time. That was very enlightening, and we hope to keep in touch on this, on these particular issues in the months and years ahead. I was talking to Dr. Malcolm Davis, the senior analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.